When I first came to Sudbury Valley, my understanding was that my life as a kid, which was running around and doing what I wanted, was going to continue at SVS. Instead of going to a school where I would be sitting down and learning things in a set order, with my time all divided up. To me, the whole idea of sitting down was just anathema. I was not into sitting down. I was a runaround kid. I was outside through most of my early school career, even in the winter, and I couldn't understand how the whole idea of being penned up related to being a kid at all. When you're a little kid, adults seem really tired and slow, and there's this big feeling that that's going to happen to you one day, so you'd better play and have fun while you have all this energy.
When I first started, I remember seeing students draped all over the place. What an interesting crew. I saw people sitting with sketchbooks. I saw people kicking back and reading for the joy of reading. I saw a kid playing guitar, and I was right over there in a second, listening, really interested. The school was more than I could have hoped for. What an explosion of things going on. You could smell the fresh food being baked in the kitchen, and you could hear music being played upstairs. And you could go through rooms full of books and books and more books. And the pond. And just the way people were dressed and the way they looked. People were just letting it loose, not afraid to sit outside and read a book or play a guitar or be interested in something.
We had our own world. We were solid in our own world. It was a world of children. We were so busy. At Sudbury Valley, there were always older kids who had done things that the younger group was trying to get to. You automatically wanted to be one of the people who could do it too, so you kept trying until you could do it. Everything was always, you have to get one step further. I don't know why. Something naturally makes you want to try, like tobogganing. Instead of tobogganing down this hill, you would toboggan down the hard hill, or you would go over the toboggan jump, or up at the rocks, you would jump across a wider ravine between two rocks. It was never stagnant. Everything was a challenge.
The older kids weren't snobby or superior. I respected them because they were so much more experienced and they knew so many things that I didn't know. There were certain times when they'd interact with us and play, and then there were times when they'd be doing their own thing and we'd be doing ours, sort of like different worlds that would come together for a reason and then go back to their own business.
For the most part, I did stuff in big blocks of time. I would start each day by continuing what I left off on the day before. So if I was building a tree fort somewhere, I would start again on that tree fort. I would work on the tree fort until I got hungry enough to come in for lunch, or, if I was smart enough, I would have brought the lunch to the tree fort in the first place. Once the tree fort was done, it was no longer as interesting. Building something is more fun than once you have it, because the fun was in building it.
Well, hi everyone. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show here. I'm going to be reading to you today, and I'll tell you why. Our next show is going to be a discussion of Sudbury Valley School. Osborne and I went down there with his family a couple weeks ago, and we attended an open house. And the next show is going to be kind of a lukewarm review of that experience. There were some positives, there were some things we didn't like, but I realized that not everybody probably has a real good foundation of knowledge of what the Sudbury model and the Sudbury philosophy is all about. We visited the original school in Framingham, Massachusetts, but this model has been replicated all over the country and really around the world. So I obtained a copy of their pamphlet, and now for something completely different, an introduction to the Sudbury Valley School, I want to read to you maybe the first 15 pages. So when we're done with this, you can be an expert on what Sudbury is all about, and our next discussion will hopefully be even more valuable and make 100% sense to you. I'm on a different microphone that's a little bit more flexible for somebody who's trying to read. The microphones we usually use, it's a little hard to read around, so I hope the audio quality is tolerable. And from what I could tell, this isn't available anywhere online. Maybe it's something that you could buy, but it's also, I think, information that they want out there, so I want to share some of the pamphlet with you today. This is not really going to be too much of a commentary. Certainly, there are issues with the Sudbury School. The model is less than perfect. As I read this to you, you'll probably be able to guess the things that I take issue with. In the next show, we will do a much more detailed commentary. So, an introduction to the Sudbury Valley School is heading number one. Every now and then, someone takes stock of the existing educational scene and starts out from scratch. Mass public education began from such a fundamental rethinking, and early this century, the modern progressive school movement developed. Many far-out experiments end up nowhere. They are the dry holes of educational prospecting. But an occasional strike now and then more than justifies all the efforts put into the exploration of new realms. One such basic reevaluation was carried out by the founders of Sudbury Valley School, located in Framingham, Massachusetts. It is a day school serving students from 4 through and past high school age, and accepts all students without regard for their prior records. Founded in 1968, at a time when new types of schools were the rage, it was based from the outset on a carefully thought out, well-articulated philosophy of education. Over the years, it has adhered faithfully to its fundamental principles. As time went by, the school has gained a track record of success with its students and alumni. It has become the subject of article studies and evaluations, and has managed to get people thinking about basic questions that have long been taken for granted. This booklet presents a brief introduction to the school with the help of writings selected from extensive literature the school has produced. Next heading, an overview of the school. Here is a description prepared by the school for a flyer given mass distribution to the public at large. Sudbury Valley School is a place where children are free. Their natural curiosity is the starting point for everything that happens at school. Here, students initiate all their own activities. The staff, the plant, the equipment are there to answer their needs. Learning takes place in formal and informal settings, in large and small groups, or individually. All ages are free to mix at all times. The dynamics among students of different ages, helping each other learn about everything from fractions to human relations, is one of the greatest strengths of the school. In our free environment, the natural differences between children are respected and encouraged. This leads to a wide range of activities going on at school, all the usual ones, and many more. Our staff is a uniquely qualified and talented group of people dedicated to the school, its principals, and its students. Our beautiful, extensive campus is in use all day and in every season. The learning that takes place outdoors is as vital as that pursued indoors at Sudbury Valley. Students share responsibility for their own environment and for the quality of life at school. The school is managed by weekly school meetings, where every student and staff member has a vote. Education at Sudbury Valley is also an education in hands-on democracy. That was all written in 1992. This next part was written in 1968. People are naturally curious. If they are free to follow their curiosity, continued interest and ultimate satisfaction will follow. People become most deeply interested, work hardest, and concentrate most intensely in those areas where their initial involvement has been fostered and given a chance to ripen into mature investigation. The American economy today is strong and diverse enough to absorb any person devoted to his work, whatever it may be, and committed to its satisfactory execution. The task of the school is therefore not to produce people who will fit in, but to fit out people who will be able to produce something with skill, enthusiasm, and pleasure, as a natural outgrowth of their initial curiosity. What do you look for in a school? If you are a student, perhaps you are looking for a place where you can find out what you are interested in doing, and then learn how to do it as well as you can. A comfortable place, where you can socialize if you want, or be left alone if you want. A place where you can find action or quiet, stimulation or peace, depending on your mood. You might want a school that will help you do what you want to do as quickly or as slowly as you choose, without pushing or pulling you along the way. If you are a parent, perhaps you are looking for a place in which your child can develop as fully as possible, in many ways, in skills, in intellect, in wisdom, in judgment, in critical ability, and in self-discipline, to name a few. Others may look for different things. Those who provide the money may look for good management, efficiency, tight fiscal controls, and careful procedures for spending funds. Professional educators might look for specific evidence of good teaching, of student achievement, of successful graduates, and of overall school morale. The person with no special interests often looks for basic signs of health, a good atmosphere, openness to visitors, a decent relationship between children and adults, or between people in general, a sense of order and dignity. There are many things you might be looking for. What can you expect to find at Sudbury Valley? Let's start with first impressions. The main building is a stone mansion built over 100 years ago from locally quarried granite. At one end of the campus, there's a large barn and stable area. At the other end, facing a mill pond, is a granite mill house, next to an earth and stone dam over which extends an old covered wood bridge. Around the campus, as far as the eye can see, are hundreds of acres of state park and conservation lands, fields and woods, flatlands, marshes, and rolling hills, which reflect in their changing colors and foliage the different seasons of the year. All this is minutes from the turnpike, and blah, 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 in Massachusetts. Rain or shine, hot or cold, early or late, there will almost always be people outside playing, walking, talking, sitting, running, obviously casual and relaxed, ready to return your greeting and answer your questions. As you enter the main building, you will find here and there some engaged, some free, all informal. Students and staff move around freely, mix easily with each other and with the newcomer. The place doesn't look or feel like a school at all. The standard school cues are missing. People are not sitting in classrooms. There are no bells or no announcements on a public address system. There are no rows of chairs, no locks or lockers, no institutional bathrooms or furnishings, only the kind you find in your own home. No administrators or secretaries to greet you. You may feel lost, without bearings. You are as likely to be greeted by a six-year-old as by an adult. You are as likely to be helped by a student as by a staff member. In fact, you may find it hard to tell staff from students. Some students are adults, and people seem to hold responsible positions in the school with no regard for age or status. You look for a list of courses, and there is none. You look for a list of classes in session, and you don't know where to turn. You look for what you are used to seeing in schools, but you don't find any of it here. Perhaps before your visit, you had a chance to read some of the school's publications, or perhaps you came in cold. Either way, you may find yourself unprepared for these first impressions. But the strangeness of it all has its good side, for it may help you realize that in order to make sense out of a visit, you have to go back to fundamentals and ask yourself what you think a school should be. And you have to measure Sudbury Valley against the answers to this question, without prejudices, without preconceptions, and with an open mind. You have to start from scratch and come up with answers that really make sense and feel right to you. That portion was written in 1976. New heading, Principles and Foundations. Much has been written about the philosophy of education, of child rearing, of child development, of the social structure that underlies the school. The two following short pieces summarize many of these views. Perhaps the easiest way to explain the school is to tell you what we looked for and how we set about getting it. Actually, we were after quite a few different things, and we found that all of them fit together into a single unified whole. As far as teaching and learning were concerned, we wanted people to be able to learn only what they were eager to learn, what they set out to learn on their own initiative, what they insisted on learning, and what they were ready to work hard at. We wanted them to be entirely free to choose their own materials and books and teachers. We felt that the only learning that ever counts in life happens when the learner has thrown himself into the subject on his own without coaxing, bribing, or pressure. And we were sure that teachers working with eager, determined, persistent students would experience unusual satisfaction. In fact, we thought that such an environment would be a paradise for students and teachers alike. In order to be true to ourselves, we had to get away from any notion of a curriculum or school-inspired program. We had to let all the drive come from the students, with the school committed only to responding to this drive. The full responsibility for each person's activities had to lie with the person himself, and not with someone else in a position of authority. This is why we have never had any required studies at any level, ever. We figured that everyone, with the help they could muster at school, could find out for themselves what was and what wasn't necessary to know in order to get where they wanted in life. This tied rather closely with the character traits we were hoping to foster at the school. More than anything, we wanted people to experience the full meaning of responsibility. We wanted them to know what it is to be a responsible person, not just from books or lectures or sermons, but from everyday experience. The way we saw it, responsibility means that each person has to carry the ball for himself. You and you alone must make your decisions, and you must live with them. No one should be thinking for you, and no one should be protecting you from the consequences of your actions. This, we felt, is essential if you want to be independent, self-directed, and the master of your own destiny. Individual responsibility also implies a basic equality among all people. Whatever authority exists must exist by the free consent of all parties. This is nothing new, of course. Our country was founded on this principle. To us, it was a guide for everyday action. You can see that a lot of concepts are involved in the idea of a responsible individual, and they are all tied up with learning the art of being a free and independent person. The school we had in mind had to be rooted in this idea. We could not be satisfied with anything less than a full personal responsibility and accountability for each person, regardless of age or knowledge or achievement. We knew that people would make mistakes this way, but they would know that the mistakes they made were their own, and so they would be likelier to learn from them. The character traits we wanted to foster would be part of a general atmosphere that we hoped would permeate the school. More than anything, we sought an environment that is open, honest, trustworthy, and free of fear. Our goal was to have a school where no one would be afraid, at least not because of anything we did. Let's be clear about what we did and what we did not want to avoid. We did not, for example, want to protect our students from failure. We wanted them not to be afraid of failure. After all, failure is the greatest of all teachers. One of the greatest scientists of the century once said that the secret of his repeated breakthroughs was that he had made more mistakes than anybody else. We felt that healthy people would always find ways to benefit from their failures as well as their successes. We believed it a good thing to let people try whatever they want, whether or not they were sure to succeed, so that they would be mentally prepared to meet an unexpected challenge or seize an unexpected opportunity. Fear of power and authority was another thing we wanted to abolish from the school. We were not concerned about people having authority. Authority in and of itself can be good or bad, depending on many things. Some situations need persons in authority, an apprentice learning situation, for example, or a business. The main question is how people get their authority and how it is controlled once they get it. You are not afraid of a person in a position of power if you understand why he is there, if you had a hand in putting him there, and if you can keep an eye on everything he does. What you are afraid of is arbitrary authority, authority that excludes you from participation, over which you have no control. We were determined that no person in the school, whether student or staff, parent or guest, should have any cause to fear the authority of anyone associated with the school. This, more than anything, would make it possible for one person to look another straight in the eye, regardless of age or sex or position or knowledge or background. We also had definite feelings about how the school should be run. It was set up in such a way that each person involved had a say in how it worked and a voice in all matters that affected him or her. As far as we were concerned, a democratic form of government is the best way people have ever come up with to manage their affairs. It gives everyone the most leeway possible to be independent, and at the same time, in matters that need joint action, it allows each person to have a full share in decision-making. Winston Churchill once said that democracy is a terrible form of government, but that all others are worse. We felt that kind of popular democracy practiced in New England town meetings for over 300 years was actually a good form of government, hard to beat. The kind of school we had in mind would be organized entirely on the town meeting model. No one would be left out. We thought that it made good sense for a school to be run democratically in a country where all forms of government are democratic. From the smallest town to the federal level, all our institutions have been designed to be democratically controlled in one way or another. We asked ourselves why schools shouldn't be run this way too. And the more we thought about it, the more we thought they should be. In a democratic school, the adult members of the community could apply to the school the same standards of citizenship they'd apply to their outside lives. And the children in the school could be nurtured in the principles and practices that make up the democratic way of life. By the time they became adults, responsible community citizenship would be natural to them because they would have lived with it for a long time. When we took stock of all the different things we were after in the school, we found that they all amounted to a rather simple core idea, from which everything else followed naturally. The idea was of a school where every person ran his own affairs without any outside interference, and where people ran their joint affairs, the school business, through a kind of town meeting. It was as simple as that, and in its simplicity, it contained the idea of learning we were after. It fostered the character traits we wished to bring out. It embodied the atmosphere we sought, and it had the structure we desired. Before the school actually started in 1968, many people said that we were dreamers, that our vision of the school was utopian. But now it has existed for years for everyone to see. That was also written in 1976. The second piece reviews the essential features of the school, on the theory that Sudbury Valley is not so much a radical new departure as it is a return to principles of education widely accepted throughout most of recorded history. New heading, back to basics. Why go to school? For people who like to think through for themselves the important questions in life, Sudbury Valley stands as a challenge to the accepted answers. Subheading, intellectual basics. The first phrase that pops into everyone's mind is, we go to school to learn. That's the intellectual goal. It comes before all the others. So much so that getting an education has come to mean learning. A bit narrow to be sure, but it gets the priorities clear. Then why don't people learn more in schools today? Why all the complaints? Why the seemingly never-ending struggle and expense just to tread water, let alone progress? The answer is embarrassingly simple. Schools today are institutions in which learning is taken to mean being taught. You want people to learn? Teach them. You want them to learn more? Teach them more and more. Work them harder. Drill them longer. But learning is a process that you do, not a process that is done to you. That is true for everyone. It's basic. What makes people learn? Funny anyone should ask. Over 2,000 years ago, Aristotle started his most important book with the universally accepted answer, human beings are naturally curious. Descartes put it slightly differently. Also at the beginning of his major work, I think, therefore I am. Learning, thinking, actively using your mind, it's the essence of being human. It's natural. More so even than the great drives, hunger, thirst, sex. When you're engrossed in something, the key word is engrossed, you forget about all the other drives until they overwhelm you. Even rats do that, as was shown a long time ago. I said no commentary, but that's a cute little reference right there to their competition. Who would think of forcing people to eat or drink or have sex? Of course, I'm not talking about people who have a specific disability that affects their drives, nor is anything I am writing here about education meant to apply to people who have specific mental impairments, which must be dealt with in special clinical ways. No one sticks people's faces in bowls of food every hour on the hour to be sure they'll eat. No one closets people with mates 8 periods a day to make sure they'll couple. Does that sound ridiculous? How much more ridiculous is it, then, to try and force people to do that which, above all else, comes most naturally to them? And everyone knows just how widespread this overpowering curiosity is. All books on childbearing go to great lengths to instruct parents on how to keep their little children out of things, especially once they're mobile. We don't stand around pushing our one-year-olds to explore. On the contrary, we tear our hair out as they tear our house apart. We seek ways to harness them, imprison them in playpens. And the older they get, the more mischief they get into. Did you ever deal with a 10-year-old? A teenager? People go to school to learn. To learn, they must be left alone and given time. When they need help, it should be given, if we want the learning to proceed at its own natural pace. But make no mistake, if a person is determined to learn, they will overcome every obstacle to learn in spite of everything. So you don't have to help. Help just makes the process a little quicker. Overcoming obstacles is one of the main activities of learning. It does no harm to leave a few. But if you bother the person, if you insist he must stop his own natural learning and do instead what you want him to do between 9 a.m. and 9:50 a.m. and between 10 a.m. and 10:50 a.m. and so forth, not only won't he learn what he has a passion to learn, but he will also hate you, hate what you were forcing him to do, and lose all taste for learning, at least temporarily. Every time you think of a class in one of those schools out there, just imagine the teacher was forcing spinach and milk and carrots and sprouts, all of those good things, down each student's throat with a giant ramrod. Sudbury Valley leaves its students to be, period. No maybes, no exceptions. We help if we can, when we are asked. We never get in the way. People come here primarily to learn, and that's what they do every day, all day. Subheading, vocational basics. The nitty-gritty of going to school always comes up next, after learning. When it comes right down to it, most people don't really give a damn what or how much they or their children learn at school as long as they are able to have a successful career, to get a good job. That means money, status, advancement. The better job you get, the better the school you went to. That's why Phillips Andover or Harvard rank so highly. Harvard grads start out way up the ladder in every profession. They're grateful when they grow up. They perpetuate this by bestowing the best they have to offer on the new Harvard grads they hire and by giving big donations to Harvard. So it goes for Yale, Dartmouth, and all the others. So what kind of school is most likely today, at the end of the 20th century, to prepare a student best for a good career? We don't really have to struggle with the answer. Everyone is writing about it. This is the post-industrial age. This is the age of information, the age of services, the age of imagination, creativity, and entrepreneurialism. The future belongs to people who can stretch their minds to handle, mold, shape, and organize and play with new material, old ideas, new facts, old facts. These kinds of activities don't take place in the average school, even on an extracurricular basis, let alone all day. At Sudbury Valley, these activities are, in a sense, the whole curriculum. Does it sound far-fetched? Perhaps to the untrained ear. But history and experience is on our side. How else to explain that fact that all our graduates, barring none, who wish to go on to college and graduate school, always got in, usually to the schools of their first choice, with no transcripts, no records, no reports, no oral or written school recommendations? What did college admissions officers see in these students? Why did they accept them, often grab them? Why did these trained administrators, wallowing in A averagers, glowing letters from teachers, high SAT scores, why did they take Sudbury Valley grads? Of course you know the answer, even if it is hard to admit. It runs so against the grain. These trained professionals saw in our students bright, alert, confident, creative spirits, the dream of every advanced school. The record speaks for itself. Our students are in a huge array of professions, or schools, in the case of more recent graduates, and vocations. They are doctors, dancers, musicians, businessmen, artists, scientists, writers, auto mechanics, carpenters. No need to go on. You can meet them if you wish. As far as vocations are concerned, Sudbury Valley has encountered future shock head-on and overcome it. No longer is there any need to be mired in the past. Subheading, Moral Basics. Now we have come to a touchy subject. Schools should produce good people. That's a broad a platitude as mother and apple pie. Obviously, we don't want schools to produce bad people. How to produce good people? There's the rub. I dare say no one really knows the answer, at least from what I see around me. But at least we know something about the subject. We know and have once again known from ancient times that the absolutely essential ingredients for moral action, the ingredient without which action is at best amoral, at worst immoral. The ingredient is personal responsibility. All ethical behavior presupposes it. To be ethical, you must be capable of choosing a path and accepting full responsibility for the choice and for the consequences. You cannot claim to be a passive instrument of fate, of God, of other men. Such a claim instantly renders all distinctions between good and evil pointless and empty. The clay that has been fashioned into the most beautiful pot in the world can lay no claim to virtue. Ethics begins from the presupposition that man is responsible for his acts. This is a given. Schools cannot change this or diminish it. Schools can, however, either acknowledge or deny it. Unfortunately, virtually all schools today choose to deny the fact that students are personally responsible for their acts, even while the leaders of these schools pay lip service to the concept. The denial is threefold. Schools do not permit students to choose their own course of action fully. They do not permit students to embark on the course once chosen, and they do not permit students to suffer the consequences of the course once taken. Freedom of choice, freedom of action, freedom to bear the results of action, these are the three great freedoms that constitute personal responsibility. It is no news that schools restrict, as a matter of fundamental policies, the freedoms of choice and action. But does it surprise you that schools restrict the freedom to bear the consequences of one's actions? It shouldn't. It has become the tenet of modern education that the psyche of a student suffers harm to the extent that it is buffered by the twin evils of adversity and failure. Success breeds success is the password today. Encouragement, letting a person down easy, avoiding disappointing setbacks, the list goes on. Small wonder that our schools are not noted for their ethical training. They excuse their failure by saying that moral education belongs in the home. To be sure it does. But does that exclude it from school? back to basics. At Sudbury Valley, the three freedoms flourish. The buck stops with each person. Responsibility is universal, ever-present, real. If you have any doubts, come and look at the school. Watch the students in action. Study the judicial system. Attend a graduation, where a student must convince his peers that he is ready to be responsible for himself and in the community at large, just as he had been in the school. Does Sudbury Valley produce good people? I think it does. And bad people, too. But the good and the bad have exercised personal responsibility for their actions at all times, and they realize that they are fully accountable for their deeds. That's what sets Sudbury Valley apart. Subheading, Social Basics. Some time ago, it became fashionable to ask our schools to look after the social acclimatization of students. Teach them to get along. Rid our society of social misfits by nipping the problem in the bud at school. Ambitious, perhaps. But oh, how many people have struggled with reports from school about their own or their child's social adaptations or lack of them. Strange, isn't it, how badly sometimes people screw up what they do? I mean, trying to socialize people is hard enough, but the schools seem almost methodically to have created ways of defeating this goal. Take age segregation, for starters. What genius looked around and got the idea that it was meaningful to divide people sharply by age? Does such division take place naturally anywhere in industry? Do all 21-year-old laborers work separately from 20-year-olds or 23-year-olds? In business, is there separate rooms for 30-year-old executives and 31-year-old executives? Do 2-year-olds stay apart from 1-year-olds and 3-year-olds on the playgrounds? Where on earth was this idea conceived? Is anything more socially damaging than segregating children by year for 14, often up to 18 years? Or take frequent segregation by sex, even in co-ed schools, for a variety of activities. Or the vast chasm between children and adults. Have you ever observed how universal it is for children not to look adults in the eye? Now let's peek into the social situation created for children within their own age group. If the schools make it almost impossible for a 12-year-old to relate in a normal human fashion to 11-year-olds, 13-year-olds, adults, etc., what about other 12-year-olds? No such luck. The primary, almost exclusive mode of relationship fostered by schools among children in the same class is competition. Cutthroat competition. The pecking order is the all in all. Who is better than whom? Who smarter, faster, taller, handsomer, and of course, who is worse, stupider, slower, shorter, uglier? If ever a system was designed to effectively produce competitive, obnoxious, insecure, paranoid social misfits, the prevailing schools have managed it. Back to basics. In the real world, the most important social attribute for a stable, healthy society is cooperation. In the real world, the most important form of competition is against oneself, against goals set for and by a person for his own achievement. In the real world, interpersonal competition for its own sake is widely recognized as pointless and destructive. Yes, even in large corporations and in sports. In the real world and in Sudbury Valley, which is a school for the real world. Next subheading, political basics. We take it for granted that schools should foster good citizenship. Universal education in this country in particular always kept one eye sharply focused on the goal of making good Americans out of us all. We all know what America stands for. The guiding principles were clearly laid down by the founding fathers and steadily elaborated ever since. This country is a democratic republic, no king, no royalty, no nobility, no inherent hierarchy, no dictator. A government of the people, by the people, and for the people. In matters political, majority rule. No taxation. You know the rest. This country is a nation of laws, no arbitrary authority, no capricious government, now giving, now taking. Due process. This country is a people with rights, inherent rights, rights so dear to us that our forefathers refused to ratify the Constitution without a Bill of Rights added in writing immediately. Knowing all this, we would accept, nay, insist, one would think, that the schools, in training their students to contribute productively to the political stability and growth of America, would be democratic and non-autocratic, would be governed by clear rules and due process, would be guardians of individual rights of students. A student growing up in schools having these features would be ready to move right into society at large. But the schools, in fact, are distinguished by the total absence of each of the three cardinal American values listed. They are autocratic, all of them, even progressive schools. They are lacking in clear guidelines and totally innocent of due process as it applies to alleged disruptors. They do not recognize the rights of minors, all except Sudbury Valley, which was founded on these three principles. I think it is safe to say that the individual liberties so cherished by our ancestors and by each succeeding generation will never be really secure until our youth, throughout the crucial formative years of their minds and spirits, are nurtured in a school environment that embodies these basic American truths. Last subheading that I'm going to read, back to basics. So you see, Sudbury was started in 1968 by people who thought very hard about schools, about what schools should be and should do, about what education is all about in America today. We went back to basics, and we stayed there, and we jealously guarded these basics against any attempt to compromise them, as we and our successors shall surely continue to stand guard. Intellectual creativity, professional excellence, personal responsibility, social toleration, political liberty, all these are the finest creations of the human spirit. Delicate blossoms that require constant care. All of us who are associated with Sudbury Valley are proud to contribute to this care. That was written in 1992. Okay, everyone, this show is actually going to end right there. Just a little post-production note. I edited out about a 15-minute rant that was inspired by one of the lines in the political basics section. I decided not to include it in this show, in order to try and keep this as positive as possible. The next show will be more of a commentary. The line that got me, quote, "I think it is safe to say that the individual liberties so cherished by our ancestors and by each succeeding generation will never be really secure until our youth, throughout the crucial formative years of their minds and spirits, are nurtured in a school environment that embodies these basic American truths." Well, if you've been listening for a while, you can probably imagine what some of that rant was about. It really went off the rails. The LAPD somehow came into it. NWA, John Taylor Gatto, the Rockefeller Foundation. I'll put it up on the website if you're interested in angry rants. But I'm feeling much better now. You know, I stepped away from the microphone, took a few deep breaths, did some downward facing dog, and I feel much better. So that's in the AV club. If you want to hear it, you know how to get into that. And oh, speaking of that, please do these things. Make an account on our new website. Go to schoolsucksproject.com and sign up. Follow us on Twitter. School Sucks Show is our name. Like us on Facebook. School Sucks Podcast. Put that in the search and you'll find us. And please, please, please subscribe to our YouTube channel. It is getting embarrassing out there. YouTube.com/user/School Sucks Podcast. There are a couple mirror channels, so make sure you find the right one. It's got like a chalkboard background that has some chalk writing on it. It's pretty cool. Looking forward to New Hampshire Liberty Forum. Hopefully I will see you there. That is coming up towards the end of next week. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening and take care.